Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Institute for Philosophy and Religion as part of its ongoing lecture series on Justice in Conflict, Justice in Peace. Speaking will be Holy Cross Professor of Philosophy, Prevag Chichkovaki. Professor Chichkovaki's lecture is titled, A World Government. Is it possible? Is it needed? We begin with an introduction by Boston University Professor of Philosophy, Manfred Kuhn.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you tonight Professor Predrag Chichkovaki. Professor Chichkovaki holds a PhD from the University of Rochester, where he studied with, among others, the famous American Kant scholar Louis Whitebeck. He has taught for most of his career at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, and has authored and edited a number of books. I'll name only a few. Kant on Knowledge and Ignorance, Essays by Louis Whitebeck, 50 Years as a Philosopher, and Kant's Legacy, Essays in Honor of Louis Whitebeck. Lately, he has been working on a book about Albert Schweitzer, and I take it that the lecture belongs into this context. The book's title is To Be Albert Schweitzer's Ethical Vision. The lecture tonight is entitled, A World Government, Is It Possible? Is It Needed? I wouldn't know, but here's Professor Chichkovac.
Good evening. It's a great pleasure to be here. I had this lecture presented at two different places already, and I thought I'm all set. And then, like most of us, I really got excited about the inauguration, the new president, the spirit of change, hope that things may change after all, that it's worth believing and working toward a better future. And so I started changing my speech, my lecture for tonight to reflect that excitement, and then I ended up writing a totally new lecture. It is not for philosophers. It's more restoring the vision that we have lost, not about the details of the daily politics and the daily life, but about coming back to the foundations, coming back to the fundamental values and fundamental issues, trying to see if the world really can be better than it is. So the title is A World Government. Is it possible? Is it needed? Let me say right from the beginning that by world government, I mean an organization that would be dedicated to ensuring peace and facilitating the well-being of the world's entire population in a just and efficient way. My question in this lecture tonight deals with whether such a government is possible and if it is needed. My answer, in short, is that even if such a government is possible, it is not needed. Inspired by the example and word of Albert Schweitzer, I argue that what is needed is a world community, not a world government, a world community built around the ethics of reverence for life. The first part of my lecture deals with the relevance of the topic. Why even raise the issue of world governance and how best to approach it? If we start with our current situation, at the beginning of the 21st century, there are a number of global and ethical problems which seem to impose upon us a demand for a great and massive global cooperation, perhaps a global governance, which would address and resolve such problems. The environmental problem is the first that comes to mind, but by no means the only one. The economies all over the world are in shambles, and the crisis which hit the United States seems to have a domino effect on the rest of the world. Even apart from this most recent economic crisis, the number of the poor, homeless, and sick is constantly increasing. The number of children dying every day of hunger or easily preventable diseases is mind-numbing. 60 years ago, toward the end of Schweitzer's lifetime, the world was struggling with the maddening nuclear arms race and problems related to the decolonization of Africa. The issues of the nuclear arms race have subdued, but by no means have been solved. a continuous tension between India and Pakistan, for example, and perhaps even the conflict between Israel and its Arabic neighbors may easily bring back the nuclear issue to the forefront of attention. The problems of Africa seem to multiply with every passing decade. All of these problems, together with many others not even mentioned here, point toward the need for much greater and better global collaboration, perhaps even a need of a world government. On the opposite side of such numerous, never-ending problems affecting the global community, there are sometimes more explicit and often more just implicit expectations of a better and more just world. Deeply ingrained in our Western civilization, and quite apparent in the last several centuries, is a teleological way of thinking about humanity and our place and role in the world. Humanity is thought of as moving in a historical development out of a darker past characterized by ignorance, primitiveness, poverty, suffering, and oppression toward a brighter future characterized by intelligence, sophistication, prosperity, happiness, and freedom. Historically speaking, the faith in that movement was based largely on an underlying trust in the salvational effect of expanding human knowledge. The original Judeo-Christian eschatological expectations had been transformed into secular faith. The religious hopes, when not entirely abandoned in their explicit religious garb, have transformed into secular hopes into an eventual this-worldly utopia whose realization would be expedited by the expert application of human reason to nature and society. A dream of the kingdom of God, this time in a peaceful earthly society, accomplished through a divine immanence working within our historical evolution, that dream has never been abandoned. So on the one hand, we have the world problems that seem to be multiplying all the time. On the other hand, you have this never-ending dream of a much better and more just world. The discrepancy between such eschatological expectations and the historical realities is not only undeniable, but perhaps also shocking. It is shocking that we dream and care so much about making the world better and the realization of just how bad things are in the world. If we for the moment ignore the eschatological expectations, their soundness and viability, and direct our attention toward the historical realities, we notice the following thing. In every society that we know of, there are three leading forces: politics, economy, and morality. There may correspondingly be three major models of their mutual relations worth noting. So, three major forces: politics, economy, and morality, and three possible relations, two of which have been historically well known, and one which I will propose, which has never existed, has never been realized in practice. Okay. The first model of the relationship of these three forces can be called a sovereign state model, or the Westphalia model, so called after the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648, which established a modern European sovereign state. According to this model, dominant in Western civilization for at least 2.5 centuries, politics is the prevailing, most dominant social force and is located on the top of the triangle. Economy is stationed in the middle, on a side if you want, right? While morality lingers at the bottom. Politics is the most important, then economy, serving politics, and then morality. The 20th century has presented a different model of the relationship of the three fundamental social forces. Perhaps by the time of World War I already, perhaps, definitely by the time of World War II, and officially at the end of the Cold War and with the fall of the Berlin Wall, the West has moved toward what can be called a free market model. So there was the sovereign state model, now there's the free market model. This model is characterized by the diminishing influence of sovereign states and the increasingly deregulated national economies. Unlike the first model, here economy holds the position on the top, while politics lingers in the middle in the service of economy. So the state is really serving the big corporations. That's one way to put it. As the last potent and the least significant social force, readily compromised whenever political and economic expediencies seem to demand so, morality is again left at the bottom of the social triangle. That's the picture. That's where we are right now. The depth of the recent economic crisis may lead us to rethink not only the role of a state in such a model, whether the state should try to bail out the automobile industries or the banks or the insurance companies, right? Not just the role of the state, but even, and even more fundamentally, the relevance of economy in our lives. Just as the nuclear arms race half a century ago provoked the questions regarding too much power concentrated in the hands of a few who could hardly be trusted even with far less consequential issues, do you really want a few people in the world to have that much power to destroy the world several times all over, to be able to order the destruction of the world several times? Can we really trust those people? How is it that any individual can have that much power? Okay, just like during the time of the nuclear crisis, people were wondering about the concentration of power in the hands of very few people, right? The recent economic crisis should bring to mind analogous concerns. How is it that banks and financial institutions have assumed so much power over our lives? Is the common market really representing the interest of the entire community? How is it that the financial games on Wall Street can affect the lives of so many people and endanger their jobs and life savings? Some people call it not games, but gambling on Wall Street. How could that happen? I already lost one-third of my pension savings. I don't know about you. And the only good thing about it is that I'm not planning to retire anytime soon. Otherwise, I would have been in trouble, because in the next 6 months, I may easily lose another third or maybe all of it. Right? How did that happen? I mean, people work hard for 30 years, and all of a sudden, all of those funds disappear. How? By whose desire? By whose design? Who's responsible for any of that? Do we know? Do we ever talk about it? Has anyone gone to jail yet? People are losing jobs every day. No one seemed to be responsible for that, right? Like a natural disaster, right? You can't blame an earthquake or a tsunami. Back to the paper. It is very surprising, better yet, astonishing, that there is very little public debate about such enormously important questions. There is no public debate. We have no public debate about this. These issues so deeply affect all of our lives. And yet it does not seem that this crisis leads the general public, or the intellectuals for that matter, radically to rethink the whole relationship between politics, economy, and morality. Although it should, the present crisis does not seem to inspire any major discussion about the current orientation of Western civilization and re-examine its fundamental values. How is it that we have become so obsessed with the material aspect of existence? the politicians and the economists involved in the present crisis resort to the usual Band-Aid approach, the goal of which is to cover up the wound and stop its bleeding. As to any serious thinking with regard to what caused the wound in the first place and how to deal with its causes, there seemed to be not enough willingness or interest. Let us, however, attempt something like that by asking, for example, what would happen if the whole relationship of politics, economy, and morality is shaken up? Both models considered above adopt a managerial approach. They impose a solution to its problems from above, from the top toward the bottom. Yet if such impositions are always short-lived and artificial, as recent history demonstrates, why not give a more serious consideration to different approach from the bottom up rather than the other way around? In his justly famous essay on perpetual peace, I had to mention Kant, right, in the presence of a great Kant scholar here. In his justly famous essay on perpetual peace, Kant claims that politics had to bend its knee in front of morality. Politics has to bend its knee in front of morality. Someone like Schweitzer would add, economy should bend its knee in front of morality as well. Let us then consider a third model, according to which morality would be on the top of the triangle, while politics and economy would stand at its base. Let us see if an idealistic, perhaps a utopian way of thinking, such as the one suggested by Schweitzer's Ethics of Reverence for Life, may bring us closer to ensuring peace and facilitating the well-being of the world's entire population. There are three good reasons for giving Alva Schweitzer, who was born in 1875 and died in 1965, the three good reasons for giving Schweitzer serious consideration in the context of our discussion. First, he dedicated his life to serving others and was an intellectual with a proven humanitarian record. And I think those things are important. If you want to trust somebody who wants to talk about the world community, you better listen to somebody who's dedicated his life to the service of humanity. Second, Schweitzer was rare among modern intellectuals who put the crisis of our civilization, or as he called it, the decay of civilization, at the center, at the very center of his philosophical thinking. Third, with his Ethics of Reverence for Life, Schweitzer offered a viable alternative to the moral disorientation of the contemporary world, an alternative which he hoped would lead to a healthier civilization and a more just world community. Let us discuss each of these points. At the age of 30, and as an already accomplished theologian and musician, and already with a PhD in philosophy as well, Schweitzer decided to abandon his academic and artistic career and dedicate himself to the service of humanity. With this goal in mind, Schweitzer obtained a medical degree, enrolled to medical school, obtained a medical degree, specialized in tropical medicine, and with his wife, Helen Breslau, went to Equatorial Africa in 1913. Believing that, quote, good fortune obliges, end of quote, Schweitzer opened a hospital on the shore of the Ogawa River, surrounded by the jungle, with, at that time, no other doctor in a radius of 1,000 square miles. No medical assistance of any kind. Except for occasional trips to Europe and one to the United States, I already mentioned in 1949, raising money for the hospital by giving lectures and concerts, Schweitzer spent his days in his hospital working as a physician up to the end of his long and productive life. He was 90 years old when he died. Yet Schweitzer's hospital grounds provided more than a place of physical healing. It became a community, or Schweitzer used to put it, quote, a brotherhood of those who bear the mark of pain. A brotherhood of those who bear the mark of pain. End of quote. When he died in 1965, Schweitzer became an outstanding symbol of humanitarian devotion and a powerful illustration of the reforming power of an individual example. He claimed that he wanted to make his life stand as his argument, those are his words, and he certainly succeeded in doing that. The first part of Schweitzer's argument was negative. It consists in exposing the decay of civilization and the reasons for its downfall. In his most significant philosophical work, The Philosophy of Civilization, published in 1923, Schweitzer clarifies what he means by civilization, or Kultur is the word that he used. Quote, "Civilization I define in quite general terms as spiritual and material progress in all spheres of activity accompanied by an ethical development of individuals and of mankind." End of quote. Spiritual and material development of individuals and mankind. He then explains what he sees as the central problem with contemporary civilization. Bear in mind, it was written almost 100 years ago, but it applies still so well today. Quote from Schweitzer, long quote. "The sickness displays manifold symptoms, but the root cause is to be found in this condition. Nothing in our civilization, including religion, is providing enough ethical ideals and energies." Let me just read that one more time. "Nothing in our civilization, including religion, is providing enough ethical ideals and energies. Our civilization," I'm continuing the quote, "our civilization has lost the great aim of the moral perfection of all mankind, and it has hemmed in by the walls of national and sectarian idols instead of encompassing the whole world and its vision." End of quote. Well, toward the end of his life, Schweitzer engaged in a campaign against nuclear testing. Time and again, he encountered the duplicity of the governments of the leading nuclear states. Their manipulations of the public opinion, their cover-ups of the deadly effects of radiation, and their readiness to push the world into nuclear war for the sake of short-term and short-sighted gains led Schweitzer to proclaim that, quote, "The governments are the greatest danger for humanity." That's the quote that Schweitzer, from Schweitzer's letters. He never put it that bluntly in his published writings. "The governments are the greatest danger for humanity." 50 years later, if the world is not in the grip of the most powerful governments, it is in the grip of the powerful multinational corporations and financial institutions. As James Brabazon, Schweitzer's best biographer, puts it bluntly, quote, "No politician would dare to tangle with the major banks, the major arms manufacturers, or the major drug companies. These people make their own laws, and their law is the law of the bottom line, fiercer and more ruthless than the law of the jungle, the law against which there is no appeal." There's nothing you can do about it. There's nothing you can appeal to. End of quote. What would Schweitzer say to this turn of events, switch from the political power to the economic power? I don't think that he would have been too surprised. Already in 1923, while commenting on World War I, he wrote in Philosophy of Civilization, I quote, "If we go to rock bottom, it was machinery and world commerce which brought about the World War." Already in 1923, he said, it was the world commerce and machinery. That's why people fought that war. His books leaves no doubt that Schweitzer clearly saw, or foresaw, the dangers of greed and ruthless competition, eternally trying to invent new ways of making new products, finding cheap labors, and making more profit. He had no illusion about the dangers of the increasing industrialization, which leads to overwork, superficiality, ever-narrowing specialization, over-organization, mechanization of virtually every aspect of life, and loss of faith in truth and humanity. In a world dominated by economy and politics, everything is proclaimed to have an instrumental value, the value determined by the ever-changing market. Despite such proclamations, political and financial institutions seem to put themselves above all values. Without any good justification, they put themselves above all humanity. To quote Brabazon again, I suggest that the law of the market and its justification by the law of the jungle is just another of the great 20th century follies like communism and fascism. And like them, it may well be due for the chop. Communism and fascism, once seemingly all-powerful, faded away not only through the efforts of their enemies, but through their own internal tensions, pressures, and defiance of the basic laws of common humanity, which will finally break through any oppression as grass will finally break through concrete. End of quote. The second and more important part of Schweitzer's argument is his positive vision of what civilization should be like, as it is articulated through his ethics of reverence for life. For a basic description of what this vision involves, it may be best to quote Schweitzer himself, and I'll give you four short quotes from his major works. One, ethics is nothing else than reverence for life. Reverence for life affords us the fundamental principle of morality, namely, that good consists in maintaining, assisting, and enhancing life, and that to destroy, to harm, or to hinder life is evil. The second quote. Reverence for life arising from the will to live that is inspired by thought contains the affirmation of life and ethics inseparably combined. It seeks to create values and to make progress of various kinds that will serve the material, spiritual, and ethical development of the individual and of mankind. Third quote. The maintenance of one's own life at the highest level by becoming more and more perfect in spirit, and the maintenance at the highest level of other life by sympathetic, helpful self-devotion to it, this is ethics. That's what ethics is about. What we call love is in its essence reverence for life. All material and spiritual values are values only insofar as they serve the maintenance of life at its highest level and the furtherance of life. One more quote. Reverence for the infinity of life means removal of strangeness, the restoration of shared experiences and of compassion and sympathy. And reason discovers the connecting link between the love for God and love for humanity. Love for all creatures, reverence for all being, and compassionate sharing of experiences with all of life, no matter how externally dissimilar to our own. End of quote. Even these short quotes give us a sufficient indication of the main features of Schweitzer's ethical vision and its differences from the most popular ethical theories. Like Kant, Schweitzer does not think highly of utilitarianism, nor does he put emphasis on the consequences of our actions. The motives of our actions, or what Kant called goodwill, are far more important for Schweitzer than their consequences. Yet unlike Kant, for whom Schweitzer always had the deepest admiration and wrote his doctoral dissertation in philosophy on Kant, on Kant's philosophy of religion, unlike Kant, Schweitzer does not put emphasis on any moral law or the categorical imperative. Schweitzer's ethics is not an ethics of conduct, but an ethics of aspiration. Reverence for life, so in other words, this means that reverence for life does not tell me what to do specifically. It tells me what to aspire toward. It's more like the ancient Greek ethics of Plato and Socrates and Aristotle than like the modern ethics that are called the ethics of conduct. Reverence for life deals with our highest aspirations, which Weitzer also calls ethical ideals, and which he understands not in terms of ethical prescriptions, but as ethical energy. Like life itself, this energy is something fluid and dynamic, something which leads us to take an affirmative attitude, not only towards human life, but all life without differentiation. Life, then, is for Schweitzer the central ethical and philosophical category, an intrinsic value, not an instrumental value, an intrinsic value, the bottom line on which everything else should be built. By emphasizing the relevance of life, Schweitzer wants to redirect our attention from the world of things, with a capital T, from our addiction to acquiring more and more things and worshiping dead idols of the materialistically obsessed civilization. Life is that which links us with other creatures. Our dependency on and interconnectedness with other forms of life leads us to realize that we are not alone in the world, nor that the world and its creatures are the playground for the satisfaction of our needs. Only selfish and immature children refuse to share their toys with other children. Only selfish and immature adults refuse to recognize their share of responsibility toward everything else that is alive and shares an urge to live, which Schweitzer calls will to live. Schweitzer insists that the previous ethical theories have been based on a too narrow foundation by focusing only on our obligations toward other human beings. Yet such obligations exist toward everything that lives. As Schweitzer put it once, quote, as the man with 10 talents toward the man of 1 talent, so man must feel toward animals, insects, and plants. End of quote. The word obligation does not properly express the whole complexity of our ethical attitude toward other living beings. This is why Schweitzer reverts to the phrase reverence for life. Reverence is stronger and more demanding than mere respect for others or of others, and also stronger than a minimalist assertion of inalienable human and animal rights. It is based on an affirmative and loving attitude. Reverence for life thus provides a general framework of orientation, which Schweitzer further clarifies as follows, the 6 points that I will mention later, only 2 for now. 1, being ruled by the longing to preserve and promote life. Being ruled by the longing to preserve and promote life. And 2, becoming more and more obstinate in resistance to the necessity for destroying or injuring life. How such general attitudes are to be translated in practice depends first on the context in which one finds oneself, and second on the level of individual maturity of every person, of every moral agent. So how we are going to translate the reverence for life into practice depends on the context and depends on our own individual level of maturity, moral growth, moral development. An individual's attitude of reverence for life, as well as his or her perception of the demands of the context and the level of personal maturity, is not primarily based on one's knowledge. That's an important thing, because the whole history of Western civilization is basing its hope on knowledge, on increasing knowledge, or acquiring more knowledge, dispelling ignorance. Schweitzer does not find knowledge to be the foundation of his ethics or his general attitude. The ethics of reverence for life does not rely on our comprehensive worldview, nor is Schweitzer willing to advocate that view, the view that virtue is or is based on knowledge. He insists that we cannot know the meaning of the world as a whole. We cannot know the meaning of the world as a whole, just as we cannot, with any assurance, assume that nature acts purposively or that human beings are headed in the direction of greater and greater progress. We can never know such things. There's no knowledge of such things. If we ask, quote, are we the children of God's love or orphans of the cosmic storm? We simply cannot know the answer to this question. Moreover, we must recognize that besides our limited knowledge, our actions can change the world only to a limited degree. There are some things we cannot change. An element of resignation and acceptance of the cognitive and pragmatic limitations is indispensable for the proper ethical attitude. I cannot but have a feeling that we are putting too many expectations on the shoulders of our new president, that we are building up expectations beyond any reasonable possibility of him and his administration solving all of that, those problems and solving them in a reasonable foreseeable future. This is why an important feature of Schweitzer's ethical vision is his synthetic approach. Since we cannot fully rely on our reason or knowledge, nor on our will, because there are some things we cannot do, we are restrained, not capable of changing, we must, out of necessity, Schweitzer thinks, try to use all of our faculties, combine what is the best in us, and see how they work together. In this spirit, he lists six defining characteristics of his theory. One, the ethics of reverence for life is natural, has a natural foundation, in a sense in which Hume claims that sympathy is natural. There's something built into us to feel sympathy toward the creatures that are suffering. Two, this sympathy, which lies at the bottom of reverence for life, is part of our psychological and physiological makeup. One or the other, it's hard to say. By using several examples, Schweitzer tries to show that even animals display the rudiments of this sympathy. This disposition, given to us naturally, we need to develop in the direction of full-blown morality. So simply to have this sympathy does not mean that we are moral creatures. This sympathy, this natural disposition, is yet to be developed toward a fully-fledged moral disposition. Three, the ethics of reverence for life is universal insofar as it applies to all living beings. Four, this ethics is absolute in the sense of being contrasted to what is practicable and achievable. It poses an absolute demand of us, even if it cannot be fully realized in practice. Just as we have to, if we think that we are created in the image of Jesus and that our goal is to approximate that ideal, Jesus, as much as possible, we still don't know that we are never going to be perfect as Jesus. That does not mean that we shouldn't be trying to become as good as possible, as perfect as possible. Okay? In that sense, also the ethics of reverence for life makes this absolute demand. The next one, number five, this ethics is rational. That's important for Schweitzer. A combination of natural dispositions, emotions, and rationality. This ethics is rational because it is developed as a result of thinking about life. He constantly reminds us we need to think and we need to think hard before we make our ethical decisions. And lastly, the ethics of reverence for life has spiritual significance, another very important thing for Schweitzer. Ethics and spirituality for him go together. Which does not necessarily mean a narrow religious spirituality, but spirituality in a much broader sense. The ethics of reverence for life has spiritual significance insofar as it seeks to attain harmony with the mysterious spirit of the universe. Although Schweitzer offers a new ethical theory, his synthetic approach is further revealed in his acknowledged sources of inspiration, which reveal not only his desire to take into account the wisdom of various epochs, but also the wisdom of various philosophical and religious traditions. Without any particular order, these sources of inspiration can be listed as follows. One, the spiritual aspect of his ethics is derived from Jesus' ethics of love. That's very clear when you read Schweitzer. Two, the ideal of self-perfection is inspired by the virtue ethics of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, and later modified by modern thinkers such as Spinoza and Goethe. So an important part of ethics is not service to others, but development of one's own potential, developing yourself, perfecting yourself constantly. Three, the idea of a brotherhood of all human beings is also another important feature of Schweitzer's ethics, as first postulated by the Stoics and later developed in terms of a cosmopolitan ideal by Erasmus and Kant. Four, the idea of the essential interconnectedness of all beings is developed by Buddhism and in the West defended by Schopenhauer first and then many other thinkers later. 5. The idea that no life should be destroyed or harmed, as first articulated by Jainism in India and later advocated by Gandhi. Lastly, the affirmation of life in the context of the natural world, as advocated by Lao Tzu, Chuang Tzu, and the philosophy of Taoism. So you see, he's trying to take the entire human tradition into account in building the proper ethical approach, not just a narrow Western approach or a contemporary analytic approach or a continental approach. He's trying to take the best that we can get from the history of the human race. What can we learn from the history of humanity? And bring that together and try to apply it into practice. One further way of articulating Schweitzer's ethics of reverence for life is that of pointing out what it is opposed to. Sometimes we understand things better when we articulate what a certain view is opposed to. The obvious opposites of the attitude of reverence for life are not only killing, harming, and coercing other living beings, but also the attitudes of contempt for nature, which is very present both in early Christianity and in modern age, insensitivity and indifference toward living beings, apathy, indifference. More subtle opposites to the attitudes of reverence for life include our attempts to master the world as manifested through manipulations, interventions, controlling, using, abusing, and exploiting various fragments of the world. We believe that we can do whatever we want, that the world exists to serve our purposes, to satisfy our needs. Of course, lately with the environmental crisis, we're becoming a little bit more aware that that's not exactly the case. Lastly, Schweitzer contrasted the ethics of reverence for life with thoughtlessness, egotistical self-assertion, and the ethics of society. Okay, the last part of the paper. Building a world community on the ethics of reverence for life. Applying, bringing us back to the beginning, central issue. In Western political philosophy, at least since the time of Locke and Hobbes, there's a fear of passions, and we can add a corresponding fear of spirituality. The prevailing wisdom in political philosophy, Western political philosophy, is that passions will undo social life and that only coercion will preserve it. That's why we have law and law enforcing officers. Social life is based on restraints, and our faith in the possibility of a just and proper social order is invested in a continuous improvement of the laws and the organizations which implement them. It is this attitude that leads first to the endorsement of the sovereign state model and later of the free market model. So we'll accomplish that best, perfect world by constantly improving the laws and constantly improving our organizations. That's the model. By word and example, Schweitzer argues that such an orientation is fundamentally mistaken. Laws and institutions of whatever kind have only an instrumental value. They are neither the ultimate goal nor the reliable guarantee of social order and justice. The measuring stick of the instrumental value of such regulations or laws and organizations is one and only one: the extent to which they contribute to the maintenance and development of life, the extent to which they contribute to the maintenance and development of humanity. That's the only measure. Call them democratic or undemocratic, monarchy or republic, call them any way you want. Do they serve humanity or do they not serve humanity? Every political institution, every political system, every law can be abused. A law by itself cannot prevent its abuse. No political system can prevent its abuse. Although sharing some of Gandhi's criticisms of the direction that Western civilization has taken, Schweitzer does not have the same anarchistic attitude toward the state as his Indian counterpart. Gandhi was vehement in insisting that the political state is a soulless machine, an organization conceived in violence, maintained by violence and subsisting in violence. Gandhi was one of the harshest critics of the sovereign state model. But Schweitzer appreciated, although he was not as radical as Gandhi, Schweitzer appreciated Gandhi's insistence on a small community, the model of which for Gandhi was an ashram, a small village, right? And for Schweitzer, his hospital. There can be no world community if there's no local community. There can be no world community if there's no local community. If we don't form a community, it's pointless to talk about a world community. If we can't live together right here and right now, any talk about the world community is complete idiocy, impossibility. Only in a small community can a permanent relationship be established, a relationship from person to person, from heart to heart. That's the foundation of everything. Whether a community is large or small, the final decision as to what its future and its success will be depends not on how near the perfection its organization is, but on the degrees of worthiness of its individual members. Schweitzer thus proposes not a revolution, but an evolution, slow, gradual evolution. Not a change of laws and institutions, but a change of heart, a different spiritual orientation. As he puts it, quote, "If the spirit is strong, it creates world history. If the spirit is weak, it suffers the world history." We are living in a world in which the spirit is very weak. By spirit, Schweitzer understands that ethical energy and its ethical ideals, which move, or in the opposite case, when the spirit is weak, make inert the members of one society. The key questions for him are, is the spirit alive? Is it vital, developing, forward-moving? Does it allow us to hear the ethical voice within? Does it move us closer toward the reverence for all life? Schweitzer's ethics of reverence for life allows us to understand how morality can serve at the top of the triangle of morality, politics, and economy. It also helps us to understand how the predominantly short-term goals of politics and economy can be integrated within the long-term moral principles. Furthermore, the ethics of reverence for life allows us to envision how a moral and spiritual transformation of every individual will lead to a better world, a world in which peace may prevail, and a world in which politics and economy are organized on the principles of justice and the well-being of all. The realization of the ethics of reverence for life would not necessarily, and certainly not directly, lead to formation of the new world government. More importantly, it would lead toward the creation of a world community, an atmosphere in which there is a respect for every human being and every living being. The ethics of reverence for life would ensure that we think of all living beings as part of one and the same whole, which we can call the world community, and also that we think that the interest of the whole is more important than the interest of any one individual part of that whole. A universal application of the ethics of reverence for life would lead to creation of the world community from the bottom up. Whether this application would ultimately also lead to creation of a world government, and whether such a government is really needed, this is something that can be decided on when we already have a healthy, ethically oriented world community. Perhaps only such a community can genuinely solve the problems traditionally posed to sovereign governments, those of global security, universal human rights, social justice, universal health care, and environmental protection. According to Schweitzer, quote, "Civilization can only revive when there shall come into being in a number of individuals a new tone of mind independent of the one prevalent among the crowd today, and in opposition to it, a tone of mind which will gradually win influence over the collective one, and in the end, determine its character." End of quote. Did Schweitzer himself believe in the possibility of reviving the entire civilization? Did he really believe in the possibility of its entire reorientation? Did he not despair when he saw how his age had been dominated by the spirit of irreverence for life? Look at it this way, Schweitzer told one of the doctors who worked with him in Africa and who posed these questions to him. Quote from Schweitzer, "It will always be a terrible struggle for both of us. But maybe in another 100 years, most physical and social ills may be expunged from the earth if enough of us do our small share. If enough of us do our small share. Yet I know in my heart that some will always be left suffering and uncured. Maybe someday enough of us will give our time, effort, and knowledge to do what is a doctor's real responsibility on earth." End of quote. And we can easily generalize it to whatever we do. Schweitzer, to conclude, Schweitzer was one of those individuals who brings a new tone of mind, who revives our ethical energy, and who reminds us of fundamentally sound and eternally valid ethical ideals. He showed us, with his words and his example, what it means to strive toward the better, more just world. His ethics of reverence for life is one of mankind's greatest thoughts. His service to the natives of Africa is one of mankind's greatest examples of how human beings can serve others and be humane. But whether it is Schweitzer or any other great ethical, political, or economic leader who we are discussing or looking after, the essential point, consists of not expecting them to solve the world problems. It is not so much what they do, but what others, us, do as a result of their example. Thank you for your attention.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a lecture presented by the Institute for Philosophy and Religion as part of its ongoing lecture series on Justice in Conflict, Justice in Peace. Speaking was Holy Cross Professor of Philosophy Prevag Chichkovaki. Professor Chichkovaki's lecture was titled A World Government: Is It Possible? Is It Needed? We began with an introduction by Boston University Professor of Philosophy Manfred Kuhn. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Edward Mazulis. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.